From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Go back to 1870s America, and you would find a different world. Horse-drawn carriages, candle-lit homes, handmade clothes, and water lugged in buckets. Over the next century, enormous innovation flourished with the invention of the electric light bulb, the car, the airplane, the TV, and much, much more. It was a golden age of economic growth in America. Now, big economist Robert J. Gordon says that golden age is well over and it's not coming back. We have to adapt. This hour on Point, the rise and fall of American growth. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you buy it that the great age of innovation and growth is behind us? Can we have America without the American dream of the endless, bright frontier of dramatic growth and progress? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Evanston, Illinois, is Robert Gordon. He is Stanley G. Harris Professor of Social Sciences at Northwestern University. His big new book is The Rise and Fall of American Growth, The U.S. Standard of Living Since the Civil War. Paul Krugman writes, this book will challenge your views about the future. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Gordon, welcome to On Point.
Delighted to be here.
So, do we all stick our heads in a bucket and moan? The American dream is built on this fabulous history that you amazingly describe of a century of tremendous progress and innovation and economic growth built on that. Now, you're forecasting decades over which the 99% of the population may see, zero growth or nearly that in disposable income. Is the party over?
Well, let's go back. First of all, for more than a millennia, there was no economic growth at all. A farmer in the 18th century was plowing his field much as was true in Roman times. Mm-hmm. By our best estimates, between 1300 and 1700, economic growth in England, where we have the best data, was only at a rate of 0.2% per year, which takes 350 years for the standard of living to double. Since 1870, we've been used to our standard of living doubling every 30 or 35 years, roughly once every generation. And you aptly describe the world of 1870 as one dependent on whale oil, kerosene, and candles for light, dependent inside the city on horses for all forms of transportation, dependent on only the telegraph was the only means of modern communication that had been invented yet. And let's not forget infant mortality. Roughly 20% of children in the United States died within the first year of childbirth. And perhaps worst of all were the working conditions. Half of Americans in 1870 were farmers, subject to cold, heat, swarms of insects, and a precarious living. Inside their homes, the only heat came from the hearth in the kitchen, and farm families went to sleep at night in cold bedrooms, worn perhaps only with a brick heated from the fireplace. So this was a pretty dismal life, isolated, cold, and dark. And then the invention started to happen. The electric light, the internal combustion engine, cars, trucks, buses, and ultimately air transportation. And things that had been invented before but just weren't available, like running water and sewage disposal of waste. A classic fact from my book that helps to underline the progress we've made is that in the mid-1880s, the average North Carolina housewife walked 148 miles a year carrying 35 tons of water into the house, and all that water had to be brought out of the house by hand.
Yeah.
So that gives you just a sense of the kind of turnaround we made around 1870 from a world of just very slow progress to one of soaring economic growth.
The presumption of the American dream is that that will go on. You say, maybe not. Maybe this was unique to this period of time. Now, we get the lesson of history, but I think a lot of Americans thought that the USA had broken the pattern of history with a unique combination of factors, social and political and economic and educational, why would this just be 1870 to 1970 and done, irrepletable?
Well, around 1970, things started to slow down. In the first two decades of the post-war era, roughly from 1945 to 1970, we had the sort of the final round of implementation of those great old inventions that started with electricity and the internal combustion engine. We had air conditioning, something made possible by electricity that made work in offices altogether different in the summer. We had the interstate highway system that gave us our modern form of transportation, and we don't drive any faster on an interstate highway than we did in 1965 or 1970, and probably we drive slower because of congestion. Mm. By 1970, the entire fleet of our commercial aircraft had been converted from piston engines to jets. So we were flying just as fast in 1970, and in fact, somewhat faster than we do today. The data show that 1970 is a breaking point, and since then, productivity growth has slowed down to about half of what it was before 1970, with the exception of what I like to call the dot-com era. The late 1990s were an interruption in this period of slower growth, when we had a complete transformation of the way business was done, as business moved from paper and file cabinets to the modern world of electronics, search engines, and flat screens that we know so well today.
So we get that. We're going to hear in the course of this hour from Andrew McAfee, who says that broad area of innovation and more can continue to power us. But help us with this very idea that this radical transformation of life and the economy, the doubling of growth, the doubling of the economy every generation, people have come to see these as baked into the American kind of promise. And explain your view further, if you would, that this doesn't just keep going on. This happened in a discrete period of time. Why wouldn't it go on?
Well, first place, we have the record of the last 45 years that it hasn't gone on, that we've gone to a slower pace of economic progress. Productivity, which is the amount of output each hour of work produces, in the last 11 years has grown at only about 1% compared to close to 3% during the 50 years in the middle of the 20th century. So we've already witnessed this slowdown. And we've had plenty of innovation in the last decade, but that has not sufficed to produce more than a 1% growth in productivity.
But I think many people look at those decades, the recent decades, and look at those as an anomaly. A lot of our political discourse is based on a presumption that we're just failing to hit the marks that we could and should be hitting if we just did things right. And you're saying, no, you're almost certain not to hit those marks again. And again, why not?
Because the great opportunities made possible by the computer and by communication, the personal computer, spreadsheet and word processing software, the marriage of communication with the computer, the invention of search engines and e-commerce, all of these great amounts of progress in what we sometimes call the Third Industrial Revolution were concentrated in a period between about 1980, which is when the first personal computers appeared, and 2005, by which point most homes had been converted to broadband and most desks were equipped with flat screens. In that 25 years, we had an utter change made possible by the computer. And just think of some of the things that we now take for granted. We have electronic catalogs. You no longer go into a library and thumb through a stack of cards, and the cards didn't tell you whether the book was on the shelf or not. In auto parts dealers, there used to be massive books, and they'd have to replace pages every day.
We get it. Now, we know it, but you seem to be downplaying the significance of this because you say, okay, that's fine, that's great, but it's not going to power a future like the American past. Why
not? That's because it's already happened. That's because the great transformation in business productivity is pretty much over by 10 years ago. You look at the way offices work today, and you see something that's very much the same as it was in 2005. The same goes for retail stores, where we had the invention of automatic checkout with barcode scanning. and automatic credit card authorization.
So why don't we just open up new frontiers? I mean, that's what we did 1870 to 1970. Just one after another, they kept opening up. Why wouldn't that go on?
I'm not proclaiming that technical change is over. And indeed, I think we'll continue to have incremental progress. A few more robots every year, more artificial intelligence, more things like the use of computers to do legal discovery, which has created unemployment for young lawyers. We're going to have 3D printing, making manufacturing prototypes much easier and faster.
But your big thesis,
create.
The reason everybody's interested, is you're saying that the great age of growth behind us.
You know, it's not behind us for innovation. I expect innovation to go on creating new things at roughly the same rate as the last 10 years, or indeed the era between 1970 and 1990.
But that What's century, different? You're saying, won't be there again, the kind of growth we saw that fueled the American dream.
I think the productivity is going to be there, but we haven't talked yet about the headwinds that are buffeting America's ship of progress and slowing it down. Start off with demography. We have an aging population. As people move from work to retirement, as the baby boom generation is now doing in its millions, we have a decline in the number of hours of work our total population is capable of working, because many people are simply not working when they're in retirement. That slows down economic growth from 1.2% in the future for output per hour down to 0.8 for output per person. And the next headwind, inequality, is slowing us down further because so much of the progress is going to the top 1%.
Robert J. Gordon, stand by if you would. We've got to stop for a short break here. We'll come back and go deeper on what's going on with the U.S. economy and innovation. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the kind of growth and breakthrough innovation that fueled the American dream and whether it is over. Big economist Robert Gordon says, well, in many ways, yes, it's gone, and we have to deal with that. Not everyone is so sure. Paul Krugman reads his big new book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth, and says, Gordon is declaring that the kind of rapid economic growth we still consider our due and expect to continue forever was in fact a one-time-only event. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Are you ready to believe and accept that? Did electricity and air travel, internal combustion and TV and refrigeration dwarf what we're doing, innovating on now? Does that explain why productivity is flat? Wages are flat? Do you want to argue the other way, that the internet and mobile computing and gene technology are just as potent, just as transformative? If they are, why aren't they showing up in productivity, in the GDP? A little example of the kind of dramatic change that Americans saw for most of a century until 1970. Here's the 1939 film, The Middleton Family at the New York World's Fair. It follows a family encountering the technological wonders of the 1930s. The grandmother in the family, played by Adora Andrews, marvels at a kitchen with an electric dishwasher. Her granddaughter, played by Marjorie Lord, also weighs in here.
It's a paradise. No one who hasn't cooked over a wood stove by the light of a kerosene lamp can really appreciate what it all means. The steps it would save.
The good old days, eh, Grandma?
Yes, and anybody who wants them can have my share.
Is it a paradise, a radical transformation that we're still in the midst of? Tech leaders would say, they'd like to say, so here's a commercial for the latest iPhone 6S, came out last year.
Siri is more helpful than ever.
Hey, Siri, show me photos of tortellini.
Here are some images of tortellini.
Maybe get takeout? The camera shoots 4K video now, which changes how your movies look. Even selfies have changed. Now your screen is the flash. Actually, photos themselves have changed. They move now. You just touch them. So yeah, that's what's changed.
And here's President Obama in his State of the Union address last month, maybe talking to Robert Gordon.
Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction.
So, Robert Gordon, when you heard the president say that, when he depicted the U.S. economy as on the up and up and up and up, were you saying, well, no, sirs, it can't be like it was?
We can look back to the last 5 years, and In contrast to my own fairly glowing forecast of productivity growth of 1.2% over the next 25 years, our actual record since 2010 has been only 0.5. That is less than half of actual growth compared to what I'm forecasting for the future. So from that point of view, I'm not a pessimist, I'm an optimist that we're going to get through this slump of productivity growth that we've been observing. Your clip from the 1939 World's Fair reminds us that we have the ability to forecast into the future, just as that lady did, looking glowingly into a future of dishwashers and electric appliances.
You say so, but that's not what I took away from your book at all. What I took away from your book was that the pace of innovation that we saw in that century is not what we should anticipate in the future. As you said, at the very top, we had a millennium without economic growth, and I got the sense that you're saying it's going to be closer to that again. Get used to it.
That's right, and that brings us back to the headwinds. I see a continuation of incremental innovation, robots, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, the gradual transformation to autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars and trucks. That's going to take decades to occur, and because it's going to take decades, the actual incremental growth per year is going to be pretty slow, something like what we've observed in the last decade or so. But it's those headwinds of inequality, of the retirement of the baby boom generation, of the fact that Social Security and Medicare are going to run out of money and we're going to have to raise taxes or cut benefits in order to make those programs solvent. Those are the things that bring our economic growth down from a respectable 1.2% down to something close, much closer to zero. And that's where the real pessimism comes from, is the headwinds, not the forecast about innovation.
There were always challenges, of course, but the technological innovations of the century that you frame up were so potent that they managed to ride over a lot of those. Was there something unique about that century starting in 1870? Was there some unique array of opportunity in front of us then that's not in front of us now?
I think you chose exactly the right word. The opportunity was there. The telegraph had been invented, and so people were feverishly trying to figure out how to get a human voice to travel down a wire. The battery had been introduced, and so Thomas Edison tried to use power from a battery to see if he could find a filament to make an electric light work. The opportunities were there once the internal combustion engine was invented. With a lightweight engine, it suddenly became feasible to think about air travel, and the Wright brothers achieved that because the opportunity was there. We've run through a lot of these opportunities, including many of those that have been made possible by the digital revolution and by computers.
A couple of calls, and I want to bring Andy McAfee and Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, you're on with Robert J. Gordon. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering if the author and everyone might want to talk about it. Seems like it's just more than a coincidence that this lack of productivity has happened in the last 30, 40 years when we've seen a huge increase in the mass accumulation of wealth into the hands of a small number of people and large corporations, and I just believe that dampens productivity, that a lot of people just don't have the resources available to them. So I'll just listen, and if you want to talk about that, thanks.
You're welcome, Paul. Robert Gordon, inequality, its impact.
Inequality is one of the headwinds. Inequality is siphoning
Why?
A great – because it's taking our productivity and siphoning off at least half of it is going to the incomes of the top 1%, leaving only the other half left over for the bottom 99% of the income distribution. And to support the caller, the growth of inequality, all these resources being concentrated at the top, has left the bottom finding it more and more difficult to send their children to college because of the expense of college and because of their own lack of resources. We're experiencing a true lack of upward mobility in the United States that is qualitatively different from that in other countries.
We've heard the argument over the years, though, that that big mass of money at the top is a kind of capital accumulation that should put lots of resources together to invest in innovation. What about that?
We're getting a lot of innovation. We have the world's most dynamic venture capital industry. If somebody has an idea, there will be funding for it. That's not the problem. The problem is that the accumulation of income and wealth at the very top simply leaves less remaining for the people at the bottom. And that's where the wage stagnation comes from. It's a combination of slow productivity growth and that draining off of the fruits of productivity growth to the top 1%.
And it's not just about whether you buy a new TV or barbecue grill. It's about how well educated the children can be to help drive innovation going forward. Gabriel in Austin, Texas. Gabriel, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Love the show.
Thanks.
What I'd like to point out is perhaps like an extension of the previous question, but that the accumulation of capital essentially assumes that there's not going to be enough capital essentially for the rest of us. And one thing that I would say that has sparked the growth of that we had over the past century was that it was a huge increase in consumer goods. And these were a lot of consumer innovations. However, without having the money to, you know, buy driverless cars or things like that, how is the middle class or below going to actually drive, you know, economic growth in the future? And also keeping in mind that a lot of these innovations that are coming out of the tech industry are going to essentially lose jobs.
Robert Gordon, the middle class eventually emerged from the great round of innovation that you describe. Now it's in trouble. What's the impact?
Well, let me mention something that we haven't talked about yet, and that is the a real driver of growth in income per person was the movement of women from homework into market work that occurred during the period from 1965 to about 1995. So we got a real bonus of increased hours of work per person in the population as the women came into the labor force. And this is something that, that supported a substantial growth in the standard of living, even as productivity growth was slowing down. Now the percentage of women in the labor force is starting to decline very slowly, but surely. And that's putting a further squeeze on the ability of the middle class to purchase, as the caller suggests, the modern wonders of driverless cars and other great new inventions.
That sounds like a break right there. Robert J. Gordon's new book is The Rise and Fall of American Growth. He's with us from Evanston, Illinois. Robert Gordon, please stand by. With us from Miami right now is Andrew McAfee, co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, co-author of The Second Machine Age. Andy Mac, he's in Miami, Florida today. Andy McAfee, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Hi, Tom. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Andy.
Hello to all. We've always had different kinds of headwinds, I guess, but Robert Gordon describes in this magisterial work a century of innovation that was so powerful that it overcame everything standing in its way and drove sort of our understanding of the American dream. Andy McAfee, can digital technology and the next wave of innovations coming at us or that we're in the midst of now, can they do the same given the headwinds we face now? Robert Gordon is skeptical.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tom, to answer your question, yes, absolutely, digital technologies can, and I believe they will, deliver us levels of innovation and benefit that are absolutely on a level with the things that, that Bob Gordon is so eloquent about. I find Bob unimpeachable on history and really, really eloquent about the headwinds, and they are real. That doesn't mean that his predictions about what's going to happen in the future should be taken as gospel.
Where would you differ when you look to the future? Innovation, growth. Is he wrong that that we're going to see a real slowdown in disposable income? He says next few decades growing at a rate barely above zero.
Well, let's separate those two concepts, Tom, innovation and growth. Bob, I find very dismissive about the kinds of innovations we're seeing on the digital front. Just to take a couple examples, okay. In the past handful of years, we have seen technologies achieve superhuman performance in areas that we should care a lot about, diagnosing disease, driving vehicles. These are fundamentally important things. These are going to be economically important things. To dismiss them as incremental seems to really make no sense to me. And when I look across the portfolio of digital innovation, everything from drones to machine learning to artificial intelligence to 3D printing, if we throw into that innovations in related fields like biotech, if the ability to precisely edit the human genome is not a big deal, I honestly don't know what a big deal is.
But let me test exactly what you're saying. Big enough to overcome, pull us through the headwinds we're facing, and keep the traditional notion of the American dream alive, that doubling of the economy every 30 years or so? Or big enough for that?
Yeah, that, I think that's the interesting question. One of the things that, that seems to be going on is a decoupling or a divorce of fundamental innovation from the things that have in the past gone along with it, from GDP growth, from rising standards of living, from rising wages for the average worker. I think innovation remains on a really healthy trajectory, and I think it's going to get better. I am not as confident that it's going to bring along all those other economic measures with it. We're seeing a lot of innovation. We're not seeing a lot of movement for median household incomes, for overall GDP growth.
I mean, this gets into the economist territory, and I'll take it to Robert Gordon, but how do you explain that decoupling, if that's true, that divorce?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind is that the more optimistic you are about the the advent of digital technologies, the more pessimistic you tend to be about the future of employment, of jobs for the middle class and the working class. And my emphasis on the incremental progress that we're making, the fact that it's going to take not just 10 years but probably 50 years to have a complete turnover of the motor vehicle fleet toward autonomous vehicles, suggests that the threat to employment is really exaggerated by some of the future optimists. To be optimistic about technology means being pessimistic about employment, and I tend to be the opposite. I think the technology is incremental, and the employment is here. Look at our economy. It's managed to get unemployment down to 5.0%, and we're going down to 4.5% in 2016. You can be sure of that.
Robert?
Tom,
yes, please.
Can I jump in on that?
Sure, Andy.
I think it's really interesting. Bob's right that headline unemployment is at historically low levels. It's also true, though, that the percentage of working-age Americans who are in the labor force, who are working or looking for work, is at a 30-year low. And an economist should be puzzled about why unemployment would be so low, and there's virtually no or very, very little upward wage pressure beyond historical levels. I just don't see a lot of slack in the I see plenty of slack in the labor market. So Bob's crystallized the difference in viewpoint very nicely. I'm very optimistic on tech progress. I am less pessimistic, not so much on job growth. We are creating jobs. They are very different than the classic industrial era middle class jobs, and in many ways they're not as good.
So where does that leave us?
Well, I wanted to support Andy on that, that the real difficulty is that the middle-class jobs have been eroded not just by automation, the work of the computer, but more primarily by globalization, by the great wave of imports from China and South Asia, so that we face a future in which many of the jobs are going to be menial service sector jobs, proverbial burger flipper. In a discussion of my book recently, a economic historian said that you could take many people from the 14th century, bring them to today, give them only a few hours of training, and they could do many of these menial service jobs of cooking and cleaning that we observe in the economy.
You know, I have to just put it out there. At this point, I'm frustrated with this conversation. Americans are making big decisions in the presidential election. I read your book, Robert, and it seems to me that you're saying, yes, there'll be more innovation, but the American dream as we've known it is over. That was a discrete period of time and opportunity. Today it feels like you're obfuscating, and people need to understand which it is when they make decisions about what emphasis they want in their leadership and in their policy.
Tom, can I try to help?
Yes.
I sense your frustration, and the thing that we need to keep in mind is that our overall affluence is growing, and we'd like it to be growing faster, obviously.
But the dream is based on it growing fast. That's how, I mean, we're looking at it, next generation may not do as well as its parents.
I'm optimistic that our overall affluence is going to increase. I think the challenge that we face is how that affluence is being shared among all the people. We absolutely see inequality rising. We see a small percentage pulling away. We see a lot of people willing to engage in that classic bargain of, I'm going to work hard and I'm going to get a decent middle class life and a result. That is getting harder and harder to execute. We have tools to deal with that. And one of my favorites is Tom, as you know, is the negative income tax or a big expansion of the earned income tax credit. So working Americans who are holding up their end of the bargain but feel like they're slipping behind, great, let's top up their income. We have tools in our toolkit to deal with the situation of the pie getting bigger, but the pie being distributed in ways that we don't like. The thing that Bob and I think, differ about is how much bigger that overall pie, that overall abundance is going to get in between now and 2050. I'm hugely optimistic about that.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about the kind of stupendous growth and breakthrough innovation that fueled, originally, the American dream. And whether that is over, big economist Robert Gordon says essentially, yes, it's gone, that discrete period of time and circumstances, and we have to deal with that. His big new book is The Rise and Fall of American Growth, the U.S. Standard of Living Since the Civil War. He joins us today from Evanston, Illinois. Andrew McAfee is with us as well, co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, co-author of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. You can join us this hour. What do you think? What if Robert Gordon is right? How do we organize our society to deal with slower growth, slow growth, no growth? What changes would that require for equity, for social stability, for more growth? Can Americans deal with what he says is our reality now? Are you still going for believing in the dream, the endless breakthroughs, the endless growth horizon? Robert Gordon describes in great sort of magisterial, many say, detail, that period in which life was just utterly transformed and what drove that. A little snippet from that time, 19th century, The Memory Palace is the podcast host and former colleague Nate DeMeo. He tells the story of how Samuel Morse came to invent the telegraph after a courier brought him word while on a trip in those days to Washington that his pregnant wife was ill because communication was so slow by the time he got home, she had died.
She had died before the courier had knocked on his door in Washington. In fact, she had already been buried some morning while he was on the road, while he was racing home to be by her side. Samuel Finley Breese Morse spent the next 45 years inventing the telegraph. To turn real space and real distance into illusion.
To turn real space and real distance into illusion. That is a big leap. Are we making that kind of leap now? Here's a recent commercial for GE advertising their work on smart technology, healthcare delivered by iPhone, 3D printing.
My mom makes airplane engines that can talk. My mom makes hospitals you can hold in your hand. My mom can print amazing things right from her computer. My mom works at GE.
Then and now. Robert Gordon, people want to believe. They want to believe, and I know I'm coming back and pounding on this. Do you see circumstances lining up that we could change politically that would bring back that kind of century of innovation and growth that you describe in the first half of your book?
Well, let me turn back to Andy's comment right before the break that we need to expand the earned income tax credit. That's something that receives widespread bipartisan support from both sides of the aisle.
This would help the
poor. I think
poor.
The way to, I think the way to deal with inequality is to start by introducing super tax brackets for those who are earning more than $1 million and more than $10 million per year, and at the bottom to try to break the cycle of poverty, to introduce what many other nations have, and that is universal preschool, going down below age 4 to age 3, and for the poverty population, even lower than that. We have a society now in which there is an enormous vocabulary gap between children who grow up in poverty with a single parent and those whose two parents are have college educations. We can move forward by changing the financing of elementary and secondary school education away from dependence on local property taxes to financing at the state level. We can change college debt by making it repayment dependent on income, so that people who are unemployed or choose to go into low-income social service occupations don't have to repay so much. So there's a whole litany of policy recommendations, many of which are in the last postscript chapter of my book.
I read those, and I have to say that I read them, many of those, as dealing with diminishment of growth rather than reviving that kind of American dream growth. Could we not, I mean, you described this utter transformation of life. Is it not possible, Robert Gordon, that there's a second chapter to that, another transformation of life that would leave a trio like us talking a century from now, looking back on this time and saying they had no idea that X and Y and Z would happen that would make life unrecognizable to citizens of 2016 America? Could not that be out there waiting for American innovators?
Well, I'm very careful not to predict anything beyond 25 years, and I'm fully ready to believe that if we look out 50, 75, or 100 years, the genome and the medical research will extend life expectancy remarkably, that we may eventually be able to get rid of the plague of Alzheimer's and dementia and have a totally new society with old people being able to contribute radically. If we do have that society, we'll have to have an utter transformation of support for old people, Social Security and Medicare, and we'll have to move later the retirement ages, because otherwise we won't be able to afford all of these healthy old people.
Andy McAfee, Robert Gordon says, okay, it may come eventually, but he's not alone in looking out right now and saying he doesn't see the radical transformation. We've talked with venture capital guy, PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel on this show. He also looks out at innovation going on and says, not sufficient, not enough, not in line with what we've known historically, won't bring us a transformed world. What do you say, Andy?
Yeah, I wonder if they're looking at the same economy I'm looking at. Tom, since 2009, the costs of solar power have decreased by 82%. They are cost equal with the grid in a lot of states right now. Bob makes the good point that we should be really reluctant to forecast more than 25 years out. So let me stay within that time period. During that time, we are going to walk away substantially from our planet's reliance on fossil fuels. If that's not a big deal, I honestly don't know what is. We are absolutely going to interconnect the great majority of the world's population with each other for the first time ever, and with a decent chunk of accumulated human knowledge. We are also going to put tools in the hands of all those people to educate themselves with the best educational resources available on the planet. If that doesn't make you optimistic about the future of innovation, you know, I don't have a lot else for you. Tom, there's one other phenomenon that I've recently become aware of that I find fascinating and deeply encouraging. Since about the year 2000, we have had a lot of economic growth while using, in absolute terms, fewer resources, important ones like iron and steel and copper and fertilizer and water for agriculture. This is not because our economy has shrunk. It's not because those industries have shrunk. And it's not because we Americans have suddenly just all decided to become monks and consume less. It's because we are fundamentally substituting information and code for atoms. This decoupling, I think, is in its early phases, and it makes me super optimistic because we are going to tread more lightly on the planet year by year going forward, even as there are more of us and even as our wants increase.
Maybe there's the hope, the big hope. Peter in Springfield, Illinois. Thank you for calling, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I agree with Professor Gordon, generally speaking, but I think there's something that's missing that I'd like to add, and that is the role of inefficiency in keeping people working. As labor force becomes more efficient, you need fewer people to do the same job. As a result, people get thrown out of work. When you invent new products, then you can put those people to work producing those new products that have consumer demand. However, really ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there has been a tendency, much greater now, as I think Professor Gordon would say, to have inefficiency, what I call functional inefficiency, where consumers don't have a choice. You have to have, where they do have a choice, you have to have efficiency. But consumers don't choose, for example, a transportation system. Politicians, influenced by corporations, choose a transportation system, like the new highway bill. And there you can subsidize, through tax dollars and through our own working, a very inefficient system, which helps to keep people working. If you wanted to change that system, you would have to throw a lot of people out of work. You know, 7 million people work in automotive when you consider all of the
Peter, let us pick it up. I mean, a lot of people have lost jobs, that's for sure. We have some back, but are we investing in the wrong things, Robert Gordon, toward inefficiency somehow, not grabbing on to opportunities that are there, or something else?
No, In fact, I agree with Andy that we have a wonderful machine for producing innovation going forward, just as we have in the past. We've had, over the last 45 years, a somewhat slower overall rate of productivity growth than we had before 1970, and that's just a small part of the problem. But I think our economy is very efficient at getting rid of the kind of inefficiency the caller is complaining about. We have a competitive economy. Firms are going out of business all the time if they aren't operating at the frontiers of efficiency.
And yet you say there's not room for the same amount of growth that we saw between 1870 and 1940, that you can't compare what you call the incremental advancements we've seen since 1970 with the great advances between 1870 and 1940.
I wish it weren't true, but the facts are there in the record of the last 10 years and the record of the period between 1970 and 1990 that we're on a slower track. And I think I fully agree with Andy, who I respect as a much better prognosticator about technology than I would be. Our only difference is the speed and the impact of the things that he's forecasting.
Ed in Fairfield, Connecticut. Ed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi to you, Tom, and to your guests. Thank you. I wanted to observe, I live in Fairfield, the home for now of General Electric. It's kind of ironic that one of your excerpts was of a young woman speaking about her mom and her work for GE. GE, before they announced they were moving from Fairfield to Boston, had announced a shift from their financial sector business to old-style manufacturing because they are anticipating a demand for consumer goods around the world.
Yep.
And I think what I would like to point out is that everybody's talking about our standard of living, but there are opportunities around the world for us to sell to, for us to engage in, and the American standard of living shouldn't be our only only topic of conversation.
Only measure. Ed, that's fair. Right. Let me take that to Robert Gordon. If the big sort of super historic innovation wave isn't happening here with this kind of standard of living rocketing that we saw here, will it be elsewhere, Robert?
Well, let's divide up the rest of the world into the developed countries of Western Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, the developed world, versus the emerging markets, which is mostly everything else, led by China and India. We're seeing slow growth, even slower than in the United States, in Western Europe and Japan. So they are suffering the problems that I've been describing in spades. But if we look at the rest of the world, there's enormous room for China, India, Asia, and Africa, and South America to catch up with where the developed countries have already arrived.
But will they innovate like this country did, as you so amazingly describe? Maybe they'll have that kind of century, and the U.S. will benefit from their innovation breakthroughs.
Yes, I think we're seeing a steady shift in the proportion of patents that are being awarded to foreign inventors. And so the dynamics of invention is indeed shifting so that other countries will be sharing instead of having the process of innovation so dominated by the United States.
Does that work for the U.S., or that means we'll be in the bleachers?
To some extent, that's competing away some of our advantages. And when Andy rightly extols the progress in reducing the cost of solar power, I think he'd agree that much of the progress in making solar power equipment has been coming from China, not from the U.S.
Yeah. Buffalo, New York.
Sure, we'll all benefit from cheap solar.
Yeah, yes,
indeed we will.
Happening right now. Brian in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air, Brian.
Yeah, my perspective is from an agriculture perspective. I'm a farmer, and I just believe that if we don't protect, you know, our basic products, which is, you know, what comes out of the ground, mine, oil, farming, and the people that produce them, and then the people that add value to those products, if we don't protect wages and products, then we're not going to be able to grow as an economy, you know, across the board. I think that wealth trickles up from the bottom end and not from the top. You know, you saw it in the oil boom of the recent years. You know, there was fantastic growth in that industry, and as soon as the price drops out, then that crashes. The same thing goes with corn. You know, our agriculture is all based on the price of corn, and you see big booms in agriculture production, millions of acres tilled up for corn production when the price goes up, and then you see massive, amounts of
farms. No, Brian, we've got it. I mean, riding the markets in capitalism requires a strong stomach. It's not easy,
it can be super rocky at times, and the frustrations are real. But we know from tons of evidence that protectionism is a deeply bad idea for an economy. I also believe that increased reliance on producing commodities as an economy is a really bad idea because of these crazy increases in resource efficiency that I talked about.
But what about political instability in this country if we're heading for a slower growth period, as Robert Gordon describes, Andy?
Yeah, and we've seen in the 2016 election people who are appealing to the people who feel left behind by these economic forces. One of the things Bob and I completely agree on is that during times of great change, whether economic change or technological change, you need to make big changes to your policies and to your institutions. And I think the frustration that he and I share is that because of the log jams and because of some other things, we're just not making the big changes. We're not reforming education. We're not investing in infrastructure. The thicket of red tape and regulation is getting deeper and more difficult to cut through for an entrepreneur. So the policy playbook that Bob and I have would look very, very similar. I think he did a great job with it in his book.
Robert Gordon, do you see the politics keeping up with the challenge right now?
Well, if you look at it, there's real opportunity to go in the direction that many Republicans support, as well as going in the direction of many Democrats. In my list of policy recommendations, I'm Bernie Sanders when it comes to taxing the very upper income groups. But I'm very much on the right wing conservative think tank spectrum when it comes to cutting through the thicket of regulations, with the absurd regulations we have on occupational licensing and other things like that.
Maybe a new formula for a new day. Robert Gordon lays it out with magisterial sweep in his new book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth. Andy McAfee, author of The Second Machine Age. My thanks to both of you for being with us today. Robert Gordon and Evanston, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
Andrew McAfee, our thanks to you.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, this week, visit our website, onpointradio.org, to read and subscribe to the show's new newsletter featuring our own Jack Beatty reporting and analyzing the New Hampshire politics before next week's first-in-the-nation presidential primary. Check it out, Jack and the newsletter, at our website. Sign up. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.